Today I'm going to go in the third of a series on biblical covenants. And so if you recall, this was one of the questions and from the congregational meeting was specific around the old new covenants and what the difference is and how we can understand them. But one of the problems with the covenants, and especially if you look at just the old new covenants, you miss a series of covenants that God actually has throughout the Bible, and you can miss several key aspects of how God works with the covenants, how God works within covenants. And so what we've been going through the last couple of messages is looking at all the covenants that lead up to the old and new covenant. And in the first part, what we did was we looked at how covenants are generally used in the Bible. And in particular, what we looked at were mutual personal covenants. So these were things like a covenant between David and Jonathan, where it was between two people. And in that case, it was about a deep and abiding friendship. Then we can look at tribal or national covenants. And these are between a ruler and his nation, or between multiple tribes. So between, let's say, Israel and one of their allies. And then the third is covenants between a king and his people. And so examples of these we see particularly in the righteous kings of Judah, where they would come in and they would restore God's rule and would have a covenant with the people that they would follow again God's words. And so we see those are covenants between people. And in the second part, we started to look at divine covenants. These are covenants, of course, made between God and man. And we started by looking at the first three, the Edenic covenant, which happened right at the beginning of creation, the Adamic covenant, which started after Adam and Eve had sinned and God brought them together with the serpent and explained how things would be from then on. And then the Noahic covenant. We saw that God made a covenant with Noah that he would no longer again destroy the earth with a flood, and that he had put a symbol for us, symbol that we still see today very brightly anytime it rains, which is of course the rainbow, that that covenant sign would show us and remind God that he would never again destroy the earth as he'd done during the time of Noah. And for this third part, we'll cover the remaining divine covenants up into the old and new covenant, which is the Abrahamic, the Aaronic, the Davidic, and the Jeroboamic covenants. And when we look at these, and I won't go through these in detail, but just as a reminder, there's five key points to look at with each covenant. The first is it conditional or is it unconditional? And as you know, you might imagine from those words, a conditional covenant is one in which God gives a proposal to a man or to men, but it's on a condition that he'll only keep that covenant with them if that person does one or more things that he commands. And generally, he promises great and special blessings, blessings that are far above what you would call normal blessings, if they'll only fulfill certain conditions of the covenant. But man's failure to keep these conditions once they enter into that covenant with God often results in punishment, very severe punishment. And we'll see an example of that today. And of course, unconditional are covenants that God makes with a man or with a nation, and he does it where he says he will unconditionally follow through on that covenant, that he will pass through that line a set of blessings, and that the conditions are not there. And we'll see why those unconditional are either because the person he did it with had already shown their righteousness, had already shown their obedience, or that it's to fulfill his purpose, that he is doing something and he's doing a work through a person or a nation, and that he has decided he's going to do it regardless of what that person or that nation will do, because he will have his will fulfilled. And then the second key thing is that each of these covenants have major points, major things that are that comprise the covenant, and then looking at both the provisions or promises and what the conditions are in the case of a conditional covenant. And then the fourth one is that each of these covenants have a symbol, something that God puts in place, a physical symbol to typically remind that person that the covenant is in effect. And then we'll see the kind of fifth point, and sometimes the most interesting point, is that God progressively reveals parts of his plan through each of these covenants, that as we go along, we can understand more about what God has in store for us. And before I jump into the Abrahamic covenant, there's three main things that we can learn from studying these covenants. Four main things. The first one is that God, through his covenants, shows that he always intended from the very beginning with the Edenic covenant, that he always intended to have a family relationship with mankind. And that through these covenants, that he provides a path for us to have one with him. The second is that when we look at these covenants, God always thinks and promises things in terms of eternity. That when God promises something, it's never time limited. That God only thinks in terms of eternity. And this, of course, can give us great hope because we can see that God has intended mankind to always live with him, not for a short period of time. You know, even in the beginning of mankind where they were living hundreds of years, it was still a relatively short period of time compared to what God had intended them to be part of his family, which is eternity. The third one is that the covenants progressively provide hope for life, hope for blessings that we can't even imagine, hope for God's kingdom, and hope that we will ultimately be in his family forever, that he thinks of us as sons and daughters, not as inferior to him, but people who he will bring into his family, that he will place his holy name upon eventually. And then the fourth, which is a key point that we'll see, particularly in the covenants that we'll look at today, is that obedience is common throughout all of these covenants as either a requirement or a prerequisite of going into covenant with God. That when we look at these, and we'll continue on in the Old and New Covenants as well, but when we see these four today, that obedience to God is central to him to entering into a covenant with mankind. And so we can't separate these covenants. We can't separate the promises that he has for us for all eternity from obedience to him. And we'll see some interesting things today, I think, about when he talks about obedience, that it doesn't really change, that throughout all these covenants, it's essentially the same obedience that he's looking for. It's the same laws. It's the same basic things that he expects in all of these covenants. And so we'll begin today in the Abrahamic covenant, and we'll spend most of the time in Genesis for this one. But if you'll turn to Genesis 12:1, we'll begin in Genesis 12:1. And this is somewhat at the very beginning of the story of Abraham. And so right before here, we read about the Tower of Babel, and we read about Terah's descendants, which of course was Abraham's father. And then in chapter 12, verse 1, it says, "Now the Lord had said to Abram, 'Get out of your country, from your family and from your father's house, to a land that I will show. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed.'" And then in verse 4, it says, "So Abram departed as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. And Abram was 75 years old when he departed Haran." But notice here that God makes promises to Abraham, but it's not yet a covenant. He's not entered in yet into a covenant. And at this point, God is making these promises on the expectation that Abraham will obey him, right? The expectation here is that Abram was to get out of the country, that he was to leave his family and go to where God had commanded him to. And so we see that this promise, while great, would have been negated if Abram wouldn't have obeyed this command, right? If Abram wouldn't have obeyed this simple command of leaving his family. And here he specifically says to Abram that he will make his descendants a great nation, that he will bless all the families of the earth. And as we see with Abram, God continues these promises, continues to expand upon the blessings and the covenant that he will enter in eventually with Abram through several verses. And so we can drop down to through several chapters. So we can drop down to Genesis 13, and you turn over to Genesis 13, 14 through 17, and we'll read just a few verses here. And this is, of course, Abram has obeyed the command of God and has separated himself and gone from his family and gone into the land that God had commanded him. And here he's again separating himself from the rest of his family. He's separating himself from Lot, who had actually gone with him. And so if you think about these, depending on exactly what God was commanding, that Abram hadn't fully obeyed this command of separating himself from his family until here in Genesis 13, 14 through 17, it says, "And the Lord said to Abram, after Lot had separated from him." And so it's interesting that it's after he had fully separated himself from his family. It says, "Lift your eyes now and look from the place where you are, northward, southward, eastward, westward. For all the land which you see, I give to you and your descendants forever." Notice this word that wasn't in Genesis 12, that wasn't there, the first promise that God had given Abraham. It is now a promise that he's given him forever, that he won't just make Abraham a great nation that will live and die as any other great nation, but he will give this land to his descendants forever. And then it goes on and says, "And I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth, so that if a man could number the dust of the earth, then your descendants also could be numbered. Arise, walk in the land through its length and its width, for I give it to you." But again, here, God doesn't make a covenant yet with Abraham. And we'll see why, that he still has more to do to make a covenant with Abram, but he is now expanding the promises. He's expanding now that his descendants will he will have a land forever, that his descendants will always be there. And now they will not just be a great nation, but they'll be so great in number that no one could ever number them, that they'll be as the dust of the earth, as the sand of the sea. And so then we can drop down now a couple more chapters, and here we'll drop down to Genesis 15. And over the next few chapters, what we see in 14, that what happens is Abraham, of course, goes and rescues Lot. That Lot had been captured because he had gone into Salem, and one of the kings had come in and conquered Salem and had taken Lot and his family. And when Abram hears this, he goes and gets Lot back. And then he goes on his way back and he meets up with Melchizedek, the priest of the Most High, it says. And he's blessed by Melchizedek. And then here, after that blessing in Genesis 15, verse 1, it says, "After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, 'Do not be afraid, Abram. I am your shield, your exceedingly great reward.'" And think about it. If you recall the story of Lot, Abram went with very few men, right, compared to the kings, and it ended up being a great victory for Abram. And so here God is saying that, you know, you can have all of these things happening around you, but I will be there. I will be your shield, and that that God will be the reward that Abram ultimately gets. And then it goes on in verse 2, it says, "But Abram said, 'Lord God, will you give me, seeing I go childless, and the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus?' Then Abram said, "Look, you have given me no offspring. Indeed, one born in my house is my heir." And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, saying, "This one shall not be your heir, but one who will come from your own body shall be your heir." Then he brought him outside and said, "Look now towards heaven and count the stars if you are able to number them." And he said to him, "So shall your descendants be." And then in verse 6 it says, he believed in the Lord, and he accounted it to him for righteousness. And then it goes on, and we'll drop down to verse 13. It says, "Then he, being God, said to Abram, 'Know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and will serve them, and they will afflict them for 400 years.'" And we know, of course, this was what the children of Israel eventually went through in the land of Egypt, with Moses eventually, with God's miraculous power, bringing them out of Egypt after these 400 years. And so here, God is telling Abram about things that will happen, things that might seem conflicting to this great nation, this great blessing that God has promised. But we'll see at the end of this an interesting thing. Then in verse 14, it says, "Also the nation whom they serve I will judge, and afterwards they shall come out with great possessions. Now as for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried at a good old age. But in the fourth generation they shall return, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete." And it came to pass, when the sun went down and it was dark, that behold, there appeared a smoking oven and a burning torch that passed between those pieces. These were pieces of an offering that Abram had set out for God. And it goes on and it says, "On that same day the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, 'To your descendants I will give this land from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates.'" So now we see that God has turned his promises into a covenant that will go on forever. And then in verse 19 it goes on and it says the complete area of the land that they will get. And so we see this progression that God has taken Abraham through. And again, I'm just picking up pieces of the story focused on the covenant, but we know this story of Abraham well, that Abraham shows a growing faith in God, that yes, he has times where he falls back into sin, that he does things that God corrects him for, but what we see over this progression of time is that Abraham is increasingly putting his faith in God, that he is increasingly believing that God will do the things that he said he would do. And so we'll drop down a few verses, and you could say in between Genesis 15 and Genesis 17, which we'll go to, that Abraham shows a lack of faith, right? That God, he is impatient with God, that he thinks he has to go and do something outside of God's law to have a physical heir for himself. But we see here in 17, and that of course is Hagar and Ishmael, but we see dropping down to chapter 17, it says in verse 1, it says, "When Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, 'I am Almighty God. Walk before me and be blameless.'" And I kind of glossed over it the last time, but look again. In chapter 15, God said his belief that Abram's belief in God was counted for righteousness to him. And that was one of the reasons why he moved from just a promise to a covenant. And here again, God is commanding Abram to walk before, and we know this walk before often alludes to walking in the paths, walking in the ways of God, and be blameless. And then it says in verse 2, "And I will make my covenant between me and you and will multiply you exceedingly." So he says that if only you will follow my commands, if only you'll walk in the ways that I've given you, if you'll be blameless, I will enter into a covenant. And this covenant now expands on the first covenant, because the first covenant that God made with Abram at the time was focused on a land that he would receive, that his descendants would receive. But here he goes on and he now turns that promise of a great nation, of people that are so numerous that they can't be numbered, he now turns that promise into a covenant. And then in verse 3 it says, "Then Abram fell on his face, and God talked with him, saying, 'As for me, behold, my covenant is with you.'" And this is a key point of all these divine covenants, is these covenants come from God, right? That mankind can't enter in a covenant with God, that God decides when and with who and what the covenants will be, that these are his covenants, that these covenants that we're looking through and will continue to look through that are divine, they're his. They're something that he holds to himself. It says, "My covenant is with you, and you shall be a father of many nations. No longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be Abraham." And we know what this name, and it goes on, "For I've made you a father of many nations. I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make nations of you, and kings shall come from you." So we see that God expands this covenant, and that it's only at this point that God actually enters into a covenant, not the original promises that he had made Abram, but it's only after he had entered into this covenant that God changed Abram's name. That before the covenant was entered into, he had promises if he would obey God, but now he has shown that he is obeying God, that he has done what God considers is necessary for God to enter into a covenant. And it's only here that he changes his name from Abram to Abraham. Because now, because this is an unconditional covenant, that God can now change his name because he has changed, you can imagine, the destiny of Abram and his family. That now he has secured many nations, that he has secured a destiny for his descendants that God had been promising him up to this time. And again, it extends the covenant beyond just the covenant from land, but to the whole promise that God had made him. And so it goes on in verse 7, it says, "I will establish my covenant between me and you and your descendants after you and their generations for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and your descendants after you." So this is now a covenant that can no longer be broken. It's one that will last forever, that as long as God is on his throne, as long as God is alive in the spiritual realm, which we know he cannot die, that this covenant now will go on, that it's now as much on God to fulfill this covenant as it is on Abraham. I mean, have you thought about that? That this covenant that God made with Abraham at this point is now on God to fulfill, that God has to work out a purpose, work out a plan of how he will fulfill this covenant. And it goes on and it says, in verse 9, it says, "And God said to Abraham, 'As for you, you shall keep my covenant, you and your descendants after you throughout your generations. This is my covenant which you shall keep between me and you and your descendants after you. Every male child among you shall be circumcised, and you shall be circumcised in the flesh of your foreskin, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and you.'" And so here, of course, we see very clearly what the sign of the covenant is between Abraham and God. And this next point is another very important point that we see because, you know, as I said, this is now an everlasting covenant, that it's up to God to fulfill this covenant. But he puts some stipulations here, that it's still up to Abraham and his descendants to fulfill this one specific part. And it goes on in verse 12, it says, "He who is 8 days old among you shall be circumcised, every male child in your generations. He who is born in your house or bought with money from any foreigner who is not your descendants, he who is born in your house and he who is bought with your money must be circumcised. And my covenant shall be in your flesh of an everlasting covenant." And notice here in verse 14, it says, "And the uncircumcised male child who is not circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin, that person shall be cut off from his people. He has broken my covenant." And so it's very interesting here that God gives an unconditional covenant to Abraham, but one in which every descendant that comes after Abraham must choose whether he'll obey that covenant or not. So God has promised Abraham many nations, many descendants, descendants that are so numerous we can't count, but that this blessing only extends to those who are willing to obey the sign of the covenant, only those who are willing to be circumcised, only those who are willing to obey God. And so we see something very interesting here. This is the first time that we see it from a covenant perspective, that while a covenant can be unconditional across a nation, it can also be very conditional for individual people, right? And this is an important part as we start to look at the old new covenants, is that God will fulfill his promise to Abraham, that God will ensure that there are enough descendants of Abraham that will follow the sign of the covenant, will follow the commandment of the covenant, but that not each individual person, not each individual descendant of Abraham will actually be covered under this covenant, right? And we see this particularly as you know, we look into the old new covenants, that when you had someone like the Pharisees, that they were so adamant that they were the descendants of Abraham, that they were going to have the blessings of Abraham no matter what, that we see here that these covenants are very conditional on the obedience to God and his commands as part of that covenant. But the other important or interesting thing here in this section of verses is that the Abrahamic covenant contains hope, right? It contains hope that not just Abraham and his descendants will be blessed, but that all of mankind will be blessed through Abraham. And we, of course, understand this to be both spiritually and physically, right? That ultimately Christ came from Abraham, that Christ came from the seed of Abraham, and through him we are all blessed. But also physically, you look at the descendants of Abraham, you look at the nations that came forth from Abraham, and you can see, of course, today, the great blessings that the whole earth has gotten from the nations that formed out of Abraham. Of course, the United States and Great Britain, and we see how these nations have protected the whole earth, right? Have allowed a prosperity that has never before been seen, and brought not perfectly God's ways, but brought many of the ways that God taught throughout the Bible to all the nations of the earth. And of course, much more will come, right? In the kingdom of God, and when Christ returns to the earth, that ultimately through Christ, that all blessings will come, both physically and spiritually. But it's we see in this covenant, as we saw with the others before, that God always adds a seed of hope into these covenants, that God shows that what he has in store for all of mankind and how much love he has for us. And then we see, of course, that this covenant was between God and Abraham and all of his physical descendants, and ultimately all of mankind if they would only keep the sign of the covenant. And we see this in many places in the letters of Paul, where Paul refers back to all of mankind being grafted into the seed of Abraham. And so this is what God, of course, is promising here. And we don't know how much Abraham understood at this time. I'm just reading through the words and understanding just the strict literal words here. This is a great blessing, but God, of course, meant much more than what you might read just from these verses. And so, and of course, as I said, the sign of the Abrahamic covenant is circumcision, right? And this was originally for all of Abraham's descendants. And that's an interesting thing here, that this circumcision, while it was carried on through Israel at least for some time, was supposed to be for all of Abraham's descendants, not just the nation of Israel. And now, an interesting question before we move on is, you might say, why did God make this covenant with Abraham, right? We saw this progression. We saw how it was, and we've seen some inferences, right? It's righteousness. He believed, walked in his ways. But God is actually very explicit of why he made this covenant with Abraham. You can turn just a few chapters over to Genesis 6, and we'll read Genesis 6, 1 through 5. It says, "There was a famine in the land besides the first famine that was in the days of Abraham and Isaac." So now we're in the story of Isaac. It says, "And Isaac went to Abimelech, king of the Philistines, in Gerar. Then the Lord appeared to him and said, 'Do not go down to Egypt. Live in the land of which I shall tell you. Dwell in this land, and I will be with you and bless you. For to you and your descendants I give all these lands, and I will perform the oath which I swore to Abraham your father. And I will make your descendants multiply as the stars of the heaven. I will give your descendants all these lands, and in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed.'" So here we see a couple interesting things, right? So again, we see that Isaac, if he is to continue on with the blessings that the Lord had given to Abraham, that he had to obey. He had to obey God and do something that was likely at the time, from a physical perspective, not the wise thing to do, right? When we see in many places, whenever there was a drought, the people would start moving into Egypt, right? That was a very common thing that would happen. But the Lord basically says here that you are to trust me. You're to do the thing that physically doesn't seem the right thing to do. But if you do, I will give you these great blessings that he had swore to Abraham. And then here in verse 5, it says why he had covenanted with Abraham, why he had sworn this oath to Abraham. It says, "Because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws." Right? So God is very explicit why he entered into this covenant with Abraham. And we'll read here from the Expositor's Bible Commentary, because it's interesting these words that God uses here. So we'll read, it says, "Then the Lord then added a remarkable note. 'Abraham kept my requirements,'" and this is the Hebrew word mizmarti, "'my commandments,' mizwate, "'my decrees,'" I won't even try to pronounce this one, "'and my laws.'" It says, "It is remarkable that this is precisely the way in which obedience to the Sinai covenant is expressed in Deuteronomy 11:1. Love the Lord your God and keep his command, or his requirements, his decrees, his laws, and his commands. Thus," and it goes on and says, it says, "Thus Abraham is an example of one who shows the law written on his heart. He is the writer's ultimate example of true obedience to the law, the one about whom the Lord could say, 'Abraham obeyed me,' thus showing Abraham to be an example of keeping the law. The writer has shown in the nature of the relationship between the law and faith. Abraham, a man who lived in faith, could be described as one who kept the law." Think about that. And this will come back to as we look at the Old and New Covenants, that God was willing to enter into a covenant with Abraham only after he had shown he was willing to do those things that God commanded in the Sinai covenant. The difference is that God commanded the nation of Israel in the Sinai covenant as a conditional, because they hadn't yet shown the ability to follow these things, while Abraham had, and that God only was willing to enter into this covenant, this everlasting covenant with Abraham, after he met essentially the exact same requirements that the old covenant laid out. And if you go back and you think about Noah, I think we could say the same thing of him as we did about Abraham, right? Because what did God say about Noah? That Noah was the only righteous man on the earth at the time. And we know that righteousness is very much tied to the law of God. And so we can see here that the law of God, and in fact, we can go back, right? We can go back to the Edenic covenant, where God commanded Adam and Eve to follow his commands, right? And so we can see that from the time of God's law, that, or the time of the creation, that God's law existed and was fully in effect. And as I said, we'll look into this in more detail in the Old Covenant, but this law was a requirement, or his law was a requirement for the old covenant, yes, but it was essentially a requirement for all of the covenants that came before. And so there's a common theme here. It's not unique. And in fact, you can look out throughout Genesis, and we can see that God, throughout the book of Genesis, that man is to avoid sin, right? Sin isn't something that just came with the old covenant, but we can see many of God's laws in the that are outlined in the old covenant are actually talked about as transgressing or causing men to sin throughout the book of Genesis. So we can read a few. I won't read these. You can jot them down and look back. But it, you know, we know in Genesis 2:2-3 that God sanctified the Sabbath, that God set it apart. We can see in Genesis 4:6-11, which was read earlier, that we are not to murder. We can see in Genesis 39:7-9 that we are not to commit adultery. Genesis 44:4 that we are not to steal. Genesis 37:11 that we're not to envy what our neighbors have. Genesis 12:8 that we are not to take the Lord's name in vain. Genesis 35:1-2 that we are not to make idols and follow false gods, right? So we can see that these Ten Commandments that God spoke to the nation of Israel, that these were not something new, that he was just repeating something that he had already given, that he had probably given directly to many men before the nation of Israel, but he was making very clear to them the requirements of his covenant, those requirements that Abraham had successfully shown he was able to obey before God entered into a covenant with him. And so, as moving on, but what do we learn from this covenant? We've already mentioned a couple of things, but I'll just reiterate too, that as we saw earlier in the Edenic covenant, the Abrahamic covenant, or sorry, the Adamic covenant and the Noahic covenant, that God's original intent and that the God's intent throughout these covenants is to have a family relationship with mankind. And that as we see, particularly in this, but even in the ones past, that God's goal to have a family has not changed, but obedience is key to whether we will be in this family relationship with God, that obedience is key throughout these covenants. And the second one is that covenants can be broadly applicable, can be broadly unconditional, but personally they can have conditions, and that condition is always obedience. That throughout all of these covenants, God makes very clear that we are to obey him, to obey his words, to obey his laws, if we are to be able to fall under these covenants. And so we'll go on to the next one. This is the Aaronic covenant. This is in Numbers. We'll turn to Numbers 18:8. And it says, we'll skip down for time, but if you go back and you read Numbers 18:8 through 19, you'll see the full scope of this promise that God gave to Aaron. But I'll just read the beginning here. It says, "And the Lord spoke to Aaron," right? And so normally when you look throughout Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, what you see is the Lord speaking to Moses, right? This is the most common. But here the Lord is actually speaking to Aaron. The Lord God is speaking to Aaron, and it says, "Hear, I myself have also given you charge of my heave offerings, all the holy gifts of the children of Israel. I have given them as a portion to you and your sons as an ordinance forever." Again, see this concept of forever, that God makes these promises not just for short periods of time, but forever. And it's interesting, this heave offering. I've been started the Bible study series on the offerings, and when I won't go into it because I could spend the rest of the time just on this point, but the heave offering has a very interesting and a very special meaning here. And when you see this promise that God gives to Aaron, it's important to understand both the physical meaning of the heave offering, but the spiritual meaning. And it gives more depth into what God is actually promising to Aaron here. But we'll drop down, and he basically goes on and he talks about all the offerings that he gives to Aaron's sons. And it's many of the offerings, not all, but many of the offerings were given to Aaron and his son. And this, of course, was their inheritance, right? Their inheritance wasn't land in the nation of Israel. Their inheritance was actually offerings offered up to God. So it's very, very interesting to see. And then it goes on and it says, if I can find my place, it goes on and it says in verse 18, and it says, "And their flesh shall be yours," talking about the firstborn of a cow or of a sheep. And it says, "Just as the wave breast and the right thighs are yours, all the heave offerings of the holy things." So again, God is offering to Aaron holy things. It says, "Which the children of Israel offer to the Lord, I have given to you and your sons and your daughters with you as an ordinance forever. It is a covenant of salt forever before the Lord with you and your descendants with you." So again, God thinks in terms of forever, eternity, when he makes these covenants. And this is a covenant that's unconditional, right? This is based off of Aaron, again, not perfectly, but showing that he was willing to follow God's laws. And then we'll drop down, and this is actually an extension, and sometimes people break these up into two different covenants, but for this purpose, I'll combine them into one. This is in Numbers 25 and verse 10, and this is the children of Israel had gone and were, of course, not yet in the promised land, but were in the nation of Midian, and here they entered into Baal worship with the Midianites. The women of Midian came in and took them away from God. And it says here, what had happened was God had gotten angry with them for worshiping Baal, of course. And not only that, but one man had brought a Midianite woman who he had married into the front of the temple, so into the presence of God, you might say. And then Eleazar, a son of Aaron, had picked up a javelin, it said, and had driven it through both the man and the woman, who were unclean because they had been worshiping Baal, and they were unclean in the presence of God. And there, here in Numbers 25 and verse 10, it says, "Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Phinehas, the son of Eleazar," or sorry, it was Phinehas, not Eleazar, "but Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, has turned back my wrath for the children of Israel, because he was zealous with my zeal among them, so that I did not consume the children of Israel in my zeal. It says, therefore say, behold, I give him my covenant of peace. And it shall be to him and his descendants after him a covenant of an everlasting priesthood, that he shall be zealous for God and made atonement for the children of Israel." And so, for lack of time, I won't spend much time here, but this is an interesting area to read and understand how these are combined. And I'll just give out one scripture where we can see that salt and peace are very, very often put together. And this is in Mark 9:50. It says, "Salt is good, but if the salt loses its flavor, how will you season it? Have salt in yourself and have peace with one another." So it's interesting here how God first makes a covenant of salt with Aaron, and then makes a covenant of peace with one of Aaron's descendants, Phinehas. And this is an everlasting covenant. And, you know, I'll say I can't completely explain how this priesthood and the everlasting priesthood of Melchizedek align. I have some ideas of how it would probably happen. But here we see that while God promised or said that Melchizedek would have an everlasting priesthood, we also see that Aaron and his descendants will have some purpose, some special part forever in the priesthood. Right, so it's interesting thing here that we see that God can make multiple promises in a similar area, and that's because God's kingdom, as we know, is ever growing. Right, is everlasting. It's always there, and that, as he says, he has many mansions, many offices, many positions for us, and so he can give these out as he wills. And I'll go through the next two. I won't read all the scriptures associated with them, but go through the next two fairly quickly, because again, we see this again, we see some interesting things. And so the first one is the Davidic covenant. And I'll just tell you, because we're very familiar with it, we'll just read one set of verses. 2 Samuel 7:12 through 16, it says, "When your days are fulfilled and you rest with your fathers, I will set up your seed after you, and you will who will come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. And he shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he shall be my son. If he commits iniquity, I will chasten him with the rod of men and with the blows of the sons of men. But my mercy shall not depart from him, as I took it from Saul, who I removed from before you. And your house and your kingdom shall be established forever before you. Your throne shall be established forever." And so we see, of course, that God set up an everlasting throne for David that will both spiritually go through Christ, but also physically go through David himself, that David will again be restored ultimately to the throne of Israel. And then this second one is another interesting one. So this is Jeroboam, right? And we hopefully know the story of Jeroboam, that Solomon had chosen to disobey God and had the kingdom removed, or half the kingdom removed from his son, and that God chose Jeroboam, a servant of Solomon, to sit on the throne of Israel. And we see in 1 Kings 11:31, and we won't read all of this, but through 39, we see that God goes to Jeroboam and gives him a chance at a covenant, similar to the one that God had with David. And it says in verse 37, I'll read just 37 and 38, it says, "So I will take you, and you shall reign over all your heart's desires, and you shall be king over Israel. Then it shall be, if you heed all that I command, walk in my ways, do what is right in my sight, to keep my statutes and my commandments." Again, the same words that were used in the old covenant, the same words that were used in talking about Abraham. And it says, "As my servant David did." So we know that God knew that David had followed these things. Goes on and says, "Then I will be with you and build for you an enduring house, a house that would never end, as I built for David, and I will give Israel to you. And I will afflict the descendants of David because of this, but not forever." So we see here that Jeroboam had a very similar promise, a very similar covenant held out to him that David had, that all he had to do was obey God, and he and his descendants could have sat on the throne of the 10 tribes of Israel forever, right? That didn't negate the promise that God had made to David. David would still be over the combined house of Israel, but that Jeroboam had this chance to be over the 10 tribes. But we see further down in 1 Kings 14, and you can read 14:6 through 16, but I'll just read 9 through 10. It says, "But you have done more evil than all who were before you, for you have gone and made for yourselves other gods and molten images, and to provoke me to anger, and have cast me down behind your back. Therefore, behold, I will bring disaster on the house of Jeroboam, and will cut off from Jeroboam every male in Israel, bond and free, and I will take away the remnant of the house of Jeroboam as one takes away refuge until it is all gone." Right? So we see that Jeroboam didn't follow the requirements of the covenant. Jeroboam did not obey God, did not follow God's commands, and because of it, God revoked the covenant. And not only did God revoke the covenant, but God took away the house of Israel from Jeroboam. And it's interesting, no more of the kings of Israel did he give this covenant. No more had an opportunity to become an everlasting king over the 10 tribes. But Jeroboam had this chance, and Jeroboam chose, because of his disobedience, to not become the king of Israel forever. And so as we see that obedience is a core theme throughout all of these covenants. And as I said, next time we'll go into details on the old new covenant, but it's very important to understand these early covenants to see the full scope of what God intends in the Old and New Covenant, that we can't just look at them in isolation, but we have to take all the covenants together. So just in closing, I want to reinforce again the things that we can learn from the covenants of God. The first is that God shows through his covenants that he always intended a familiar relationship with mankind, and he provides a path for us to have them through these covenants. Second is that God thinks and promises in terms of eternity, that God does not just promise or does not think in terms of a finite period of time, but God thinks and promises in terms of eternity. The third is that God progressively gives hope through these covenants. And we see that, and I didn't mention this as much in the last three, but God, through these covenants, shows that he has many offices, many places of prestige in his family, that he's not limited, right? That he can offer to David a covenant of king of, as king over all of Israel, the combined nation, and he can offer Jeroboam king over the 10 tribes, or he can say he'll have an everlasting priesthood in Melchizedek and still offer the same thing to Phinehas and Aaron, right? So that God is not limited, and that God gives us hope. Hope through these, hope for life, hope for God's kingdom, hope that we'll be in his kingdom or in his family forever. And the fourth is that obedience is common throughout all of these covenants, that it's either a requirement that he states up front or a prerequisite for him to actually enter in. So obedience is a key thing that we need to understand as part of these covenants.